Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Colson Whitehead won a following with stories that explore a world that's both familiar and a little skewed, or a lot. In his new book, Zone One, we read about Mark Spitz, who, Whitehead says, is about a guy just trying to make it to the next day without being killed, so it's about New Yorkers. Zone One is the story of the human survivors who are clearing the undead from Lower Manhattan. They bag and remove the zombies, which they call Skells, hoping the island can be re-inhabited. Colson Whitehead is the author of the novels Sag Harbor, The Intuitionist, and John Henry Days, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It's a great pleasure to welcome Colson Whitehead to The Book Show.
Howdy. Glad to be here.
It is a pleasure. What's interesting in calling this a zombie novel, you never use that word.
You know, when I started, I wanted to figure out which conventions of horror stories and zombie culture I wanted to take, what I wanted to ignore. If you actually see Night of the Living Dead, they don't use the word zombie.
Right.
You know, the myth hasn't really coalesced into one solid idea of what a zombie is. And so that word's never used. They're homicidal maniacs, a gang of crazy assassins roaming the countryside. And there are other zombie movies where, you know, the Z word is not used. So in here, there's skells and stragglers, but they conform generally to our idea of the zombie. There's a whole generation out there who, you know, dresses up as zombies and they do marches and make out as zombies. I don't know what they're doing. I'm from the old school, and so my zombies are slow. That's what I like. You know, other folks might prefer fast zombies. I felt free to pick and choose from the tradition, from stories and movies.
I am hoping that you can read a little bit from the book to set it up a bit in the story about Mark Spitz. And what would you like to read from?
Mark Spitz is thinking about how his zombie dreams have changed from when he was out in the wasteland to after he's been recovered and put to good use resettling society. The dreams changed once he made it to his first big settlement. He was no longer late for the final exam of a class he didn't know he'd enrolled in, or about to deliver the big presentation to the higher-ups, when he suddenly realized he left the only copy in the back seat of a taxi. His dreams unfurled in the theater of the mundane. There was no pulse-quickening escalation of events, no stakes to mention. He took the train to work. He waited for his pepperoni slices extraction from the pizza joint's hectic oven. He jawed with his girlfriend. But all the supporting characters were dead. The dead said, "Let's stay in and get a movie, honey. You want fries with that? Do you know what time it is?" While flies skittered on their faces, searching for a soft flap to bury eggs in, and their arms terminated at the elbow to showcase a white peach of bone fringed with dangling muscle and dripping tendons. He said, "Sure, let's stay in and snuggle, honey. It's been a long day." "I'll take the side salad, thank you. It's 10 of 5. Gets dark early this time of year." He downward dogged in a drop-in yoga class as the skell next to him broke in half while trying the pose. No one remarked upon this sight, not him, not the dead teacher, and not the enthusiastic and limber dead around him. Most assuredly not the bisected skell on the floral-patterned hemp mat, who flopped grotesquely through the rest of the hour like a real trooper. He got into his street clothes in the locker room as the yuppie skell beside him dragged an expensive watch over his wrist, grating the fresh scabs there. On impulse, he purchased a deluxe combo juice at the cafe on the way out and decided not to say anything when the pimply skell dropped a banana slice into the blender. He hated banana. He drank it anyway, blowing into the striped straw to dislodge a plug of pulp, and stepped out onto the sidewalk in the rush hour stream of the dead on their way home, the paralegals, resigned temps, bike messengers and slump shoulder massage therapists, the panoply of dead citizens in the throes of their slow decay. The only unsettling thing about the dream was that he'd never taken a yoga class in his life.
Colson Whitehead, reading from his new novel, Zone One, published by Doubleday. Do you get ideas from dreams?
This is the first one that's panned out. You know, sometimes you have a dream and you wake up and it's like, oh, I got to remember that in the morning. You know, maybe I can get a book out of it. And usually it's just something like, you know, boy meets girl, or I want to sleep with my mom. So, you know, I've had zombie dreams ever since I saw Dawn of the Dead when I was in junior high. I had very permissive parents, and they let me see all sorts of R-rated movies at a very tender age.
That was X, wasn't it?
Dawn of the Dead was X for excessive gore. I'd seen crazy stuff on cable already. I remember seeing A Clockwork Orange when I was like 10 mm-hmm. with my family and being like, Daddy, what's happening to that lady? It's a comment on society. You know, keep watching. And so I saw a lot of weird things when I was little. And right after seeing Dawn of the Dead, I started having zombie anxiety dreams. You know, depending what's gone on in my life for the last 30 years, I've had dreams about being chased by slow zombies, fast zombies. They get me. I'm in the country. I escape. So it all depends. And then the summer of 2009, I had house guests out in Long Island. And I was, I guess, in a bad mood. Maybe I shouldn't have had guests, but it was too late to uninvite them. So I heard them downstairs laughing in the morning, making breakfast. And the only thing I could think as I was laying in bed upstairs was, I wish they'd leave. But you can't really say that. So instead, I just hid in my room and went back to sleep and had a dream that I wanted to go into the living room in my apartment in New York. But I wasn't sure if I could because I didn't know if they'd swept the zombies out yet. And then I woke up and I thought, well, that's probably something to consider when the apocalypse ends. How do you get rid of the residual zombies when you're trying to reboot society? They stick around like unwanted house guests.
I was just speaking to the Israeli novelist Amos Oz, who talked about how the setting for his latest novel came from a dream, and how important dreams were to him. And the cream of the crop, if you will, are the ones that you remember, that stay with you. He said sometimes he would wake up in the middle of the night and write them down, but he found the ones that were the most productive were the ones that actually stayed with him for the day and he could remember and then think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that subconscious work is very, really important. I mean, once I had that dream, I started working on the book that day and taking notes and came up with the ending that very first day. So I was writing towards that when I was working on the book. But also, you know, I take a lot of time off in between projects, 6 months or a year, 2 years in the case of the book Sag Harbor and Zone One. And I think, and I'm not doing it that much at all, but I do think, you know, my subconscious is turning over ideas and working in the background, trying to figure out what I should do next. So that when I do have a dream like that or an idea clicks, it's because I've been resting and even though I've just been vegging, watching TV and eating sandwiches, you know, some part of my brain has been working.
David McCullough made the point to me once that it's everyone asks about writing the book, but nobody asks about thinking about the book. And that's often the most important process of the cogitating, the thinking about it.
Sure. I mean, I definitely do a lot of planning before I start. In the case of Zone One, it was 4 months, but I spent, you know, 2 or 3 years plotting out a book, doing an outline. And maybe just because I'm a nerd, I have to know what's going to happen. I have to know the beginning and the end. Cleaning up after the apocalypse in New York is one sentence, it's not a book. So who are the characters? Where is it going to take place? How am I going to use the zombie rhetorical prop? How can I make it a vehicle for the various things I want to talk about? You know, the outline changes once I start writing. But I guess my idea is that it's hard enough to find the right words each day if I actually don't even know what's going to happen. You know, when I sit down to work at 10 or 11, it seems twice as hard and, you know, twice as foolish. I think a lot about what this project should be, how it's going to work out practically before I start writing. You know, some folks listen to the voices of the characters in their head and go, I have to have a little more concrete idea.
We'll go where the characters take us. I don't know how this is going to end. It would seem to me that your approach, creatively speaking, would be more concerting in the sense that you know where you're headed. You just have to get there.
I know the destination, sure. And, you know, I mean, you can overplot. That's why my outlines change, become smaller, larger. As I do research, they get more fleshed out. Characters become more or less important and get more or less page time. So you know, the organic and wild energies of the work change a direction, but I do have to definitely know the destination.
When you look at this character of Mark Spitz, how would you describe him? He is he's a worker, not an overachiever, certainly, but he's out there doing his thing.
He's a solid B student. He was in school, and now he is in life as well. And trying to figure out the contours and texture of my post-apocalypse, I was trying to figure out who would be left. And it seemed if you were a high-functioning person, the cream of the crop, you'd probably just jump off a bridge or building and kill yourself because the world is so terrible. That's the only sort of sane solution. If you were a D or an F or C personality, you'd probably get wiped out pretty quickly by the conditions on the field, on the ground. You're just too stupid to make it through. And that leaves those who muddle through, the mediocre, the human cockroaches, who will always be around no matter what happens to the earth. And so Mark Spitz is one of these human cockroaches. He's never really succeeded, never really failed. He's been, you know, born aloft on this upper middle class current that's kept him out of trouble, and will continue to do so even when the world has ended.
As you started off your answer, you get to, obviously this is the wonderful thing about writing fiction, but taking a genre and you get to put your spin on it. And one of the interesting spins here, there are two kinds of zombies. And that was something that you wanted to play with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've written about nostalgia and memory before in Sag Harbor. That's a big part of that novel, The Colossus of New York. So it's one of, you know, the things that's sort of on my mind lately. And there's a subset of the zombies slash skells called stragglers, and they become a way of talking about this notion, how it can play out for some of the characters. So stragglers are malfunctioning zombies. Instead of trying to eat people, once their brains are destroyed by the zombie plague that goes from person to person, they go to a place that's emotionally charged for them, some place that was important in their lives. So if you were work the deli counter at the grocery store, once you get infected, you might go there, pick up your cleaver, and then freeze, and you become a human statue, a monument to who you used to be. And so they're all, you know, the 1% of the malfunctioning zombies are the stragglers, and they're strewn in different places around the city. And they're completely consumed and obsessed with who they used to be, so much so that they can't do anything else except freeze in place and try to capture that past, elusive, perfect moment. But there are zombies, and, you know, I contrast them with the survivors who are also trapped. I mean, their world has changed. They're in a new place. They're in the after, where they used to be in the before. And they're trying to figure out how to bring their old selves, those old people that used to be, into this new ruined landscape, just as trapped as the stragglers. And so as I trace Mark Spitz and his fellow sweepers, I'm trying to figure out where they overlap with, you know, the creatures they're trying to eradicate.
You have zombies who, instead of with their target being to eat someone's face off, they're fine going to the coffee
lofty,
shop.
Lofty, lofty as it is, yeah.
Yeah, I want to go with Starbucks. I want to go over here, and that's interesting to read.
Yeah, I mean, this takes off from the Romero idea of the zombie, which accumulates satirical power in Dawn of the Dead. The zombies have circled them all, and the survivors inside are wondering why they keep coming here. And one of the survivors says, well, this is an important place in their lives. They have nowhere else to go. So even though they're dead, they have to go to the mall. That's like the one thing that's keeping them moving after their brains have turned to mush. Your former world has been completely destroyed, and you have to find a new way of going about being in the world.
Colson Whitehead is our guest. His new novel is Zone One, and the book is published by Doubleday. I've heard you speak, and I've read a few interviews, and one of the things that I respect about you, besides your obvious literary talent, is that when asked to explain a scene or explain a thought behind something, you are very quick to say that pretty much what you had to say about that subject is on that page, that there's not a whole lot of room for interpretation, that you want to weave it as it is for it to be somewhat pure, if you will.
I can talk about the premise of the book, which is a bunch of people trying to resettle Manhattan after the apocalypse. Was it about, if I could make that into one sentence, it wouldn't be a book, you know. About 8 years ago, I wanted to, you know, because of my childhood fascination with horror movies and books, I thought I might write a nonfiction essay about my interpretation of the zombie, what it means in pop culture. And I realized, I couldn't do that in an essay. It was much bigger than an essay. It was more than laying out a set of terms, a cultural history of the zombie. Just because it's so tied to my psychology and my paranoid formation about people in the world. So it became a book and not, say a 1,500-word essay. So, if you could boil these things down, they wouldn't be novels. They'd be, conversations or articles.
But you like the novel to speak for itself.
Sure. I often get asked about interpretations, like, what does this mean or that mean? Once I'm done, it's yours. And I can't, maybe it's just because I went to college in the 80s and death of the author and stuff, it's all yours. But it's sort of out of my hands as to what you're going to take from it. I hope that you don't say, Zone One is in support of the ethnic cleansing of this this ethnic, this group. Stick away from violence and genocide. But besides that, the book is yours to interpret.
Do you care in the sense of, is there an interest when people talk to you about their interpretation?
Well, I hope they get it, and I hope they, it was worth their while to get to the last page.
But are you fascinated by that, or does that not help you in any real way?
No, the project is definitely done when, I hand it in or give it out to other people to read, experience for themselves. You have a few books, and they've been out for a while, and some have been adopted in colleges or high schools. I have seen some academic criticism of the books. It's so abstracted from me just sitting in my underwear in my house, surrounded by takeout, and thinking up the stuff that it's hard to relate to.
How much in this novel, Zone One, is a New York story? I read the quote at the beginning of this being about your hometown.
Well, it's my first novel set in New York City, where I grew up. And in addition to devouring zombie movies and post-apocalyptic movies, I lived in a kind of disaster-struck New York in the 70s and 80s, with garbage strikes, train strikes, everything covered in graffiti, absurd amounts of crime. And that ruined city is, my elemental idea of what the city looks like. So imagining an apocalypse for my hometown isn't that hard because I've seen it ruined. I've seen it under attack. I've seen people on the run. And I have a lot to just draw on in terms of making a New York-centric apocalypse. Some of the ideas and perceptions of Mark Spitz as he moves through the city come from the Colossus of New York. They're altered and changed by his damaged, traumatized psychology. So that was sort of interesting to, take my ideas of how I experience a city and then alter them to make them, suit this character's progress through the metropolis.
With that said, that book was written almost 10 years ago, right? And so have your thoughts on the city changed since you wrote Colossus, New York? Because you're older, you have experienced more.
Yeah, I think what animates Mark Spitz's desire to reboot, to help with the resettling of New York City, is this idea of coming to New York to reinvent yourself. We hear about in songs and brochures and movies, the folks from the country coming to the big city, having adventures and becoming that sophisticated metropolitan entity. So he has this hope, even though the New York in the book will never be what it was. Everyone's dead, and it's sort of like a bummer. But he still has to have this idea that he can reinvent himself and make himself new. And I think, last 8 years of my life, having a kid and other things happening in my life, I do have a more hopeful idea of what the city can give you. That's why I stay there and having and bringing, up a daughter in the city makes me realize how much I valued growing up there. And hopefully she can still, as she grows up there, have that same sort of not magical, that's a bit ridiculous, but worthwhile and enchanting relationship with her hometown.
In the beginning of the book, you write about Mark and you say he was a mote cycling in the wheels of a giant clock. Millions of people tended to this magnificent contraption. They lived and sweated and toiled in it, serving the mechanism of metropolis and making it bigger, better, story by glorious story and idea by unlikely idea. We've talked a lot about the content, but I want to talk to you about the language of the book, because you're a beautiful writer. It's a gorgeous piece to read, which I think, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, which allows it to be as bleak as it is without being overly bleak.
Okay, that's good. I mean, I think when I started, I wanted to be super bleak, super downbeat. My previous book, Sag Harbor, is about a kid growing up, and no matter what happens to him, a big travail or a smaller inconvenience, he always thinks that the world can get better, and he's always optimistic. And that's one part of my personality in that narrator. And my other part, you know, is really misanthropic, hates everybody, and just wishes, you know, I could be alone and not have to wait in line at the supermarket. So I went into this book trying to make it, or wanting it to be, definitely more of a downer. And then a joke started creeping in, and the voice, the narrative voice, started establishing itself. Even though, you know, the humor is dark. Dark humor brightens the darkness. I think Mark Spitz's love for the city, which bleeds over into the narrator, I think detracts from some of the growing sense of horror as all these terrible things are happening to people.
But the language that you use in the sentences that come out of the ancient water towers lurking atop obstinate old pre-wars, and higher up, the massive central air units that hunkered and coiled on the striving high-rises, glistening like extruded guts, the tar paper pates of tenements. He spotted the occasional out-of-season beach chair jackknife on gravel, seemingly gusted up from the street below. How natural is that versus how painstaking?
It's both. I mean, writing's a terrible job. Sometimes the sentences come out great. Usually when they come out very easy, it's something like, he opened the door, period. You know, that's like an easy sentence.
Right.
Those aren't the ones you're worried about. So, I mean, I talked about having an outline, and I'm good at that. I can do the big picture stuff. For me, the hardest part is the first 100 pages of a book, when you're figuring out what the voice of the narrator is, whether it's a first person or a third person. What's the range of their adjectives, their nouns? Are they a short sentence person or a five clause pile up sort of madman? So I remember writing, you know, those two passages. They're very early on in the book, and they took a lot of tinkering. I think in this book, the voice started clicking when I got him out to Atlantic City, and maybe moving in this flashback to a time before the disaster and describing the world how it used to be helped me get a handle on what I wanted the ruined world to look like by having a few pages that were set in a realistic, contemporary setting. I sort of figured out what the ruined world would look like and what the sentences would be I'd use to describe it. So, once I get to that point, I know what this narrator sounds like, and I can go back and change those paragraphs, those sentences that you mentioned, you read out, because now I know what the rhythms of this voice are. But it is painstaking, horrible, but then it clicks, and you sigh, and you're sort of a bit happy for a brief moment before you start writing again.
Colson Whitehead's new novel is Zone One. It is published by Doubleday. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also go there to listen to this or find past book shows. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
If you open up the door, we'll all come inside. excited.